Ledger is a writing podcast that is ever at odds with itself. I'm your host, Austin Wilson. Welcome to today's show, where I chat with author Eugenio Volpe. He wrote a book called I, Caravaggio that's out now from Clash Books. Go to clashbooks.com or Eugenio Volpe to grab a copy of it. We chat about his process, of course. Did he write longhand? Did he write on the computer? How many drafts he did? But we also talk about civets. We also talk about Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet. And we talk about his voice and how his mom helped him come to a conclusion about maybe him being the next Jesus Christ. That might be offensive to some of you, and if so, I apologize, but listen, then it'll make sense, I promise. I thank you very much to Eugenio for coming by. His book is super interesting, and the voice is intensely strong, so I do hope that you check it out after you listen to the interview. As always, you can check my stuff out at austinrwilson.com. My newest project is called Dynasty of Blood. Two volumes are available now through drivethroughfiction.com and itch.io. It's a tale set in the 1980s satanic panic built around a fictional board game, well, tabletop role-playing game called Dynasty of Blood that I'm also writing and creating as I write the story. Having a lot of fun. Have some new art and some new modules and stuff coming up, so make sure you check that out. Let me know what you think of the show. Let Eugenio know what you think of I, Caravaggio when you read it. And let me know if there's anyone that you would like to hear on the show. But as for now, here's my chat with Eugenio Volpe. The big thing I wanted to jump into right away, page one. Behind every artist is a greater psychosis, which I think is just about as succinct of an authorial statement as you can have. How much of you is in that statement? Or is that pure Caravaggio?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'm fairly psychotic. I think it's all, I don't know how artistic I am, but I'm psychotic.
Yeah.
I think writing novels, especially, what's more psychotic than that? Just, you know, being disillusioned, creating illusions, creating virtual realities. I think there is a lot of me in this novel. I think I've got somewhat of a split personality. My previous novel, I wrote in graduate school, kind of a similar thing. There are two brother characters, but they're split into these sort of two, you know, alter ego, singular characters. And I think that's me growing up in Boston, in a working class family, but then going to college, being like the first to graduate, first to attend college, I should say. And my family sort of, I think, created this like dichotomy, this duality in me, myself, where we kind of came like not a different person, but somewhat different, and just reacting to that and kind of, so I think there's something to be said in that, just sort of split personality, the sort of psychosis that's necessary in both writing, you know, or even just creating any kind of art form. I feel like all the best artists, in my opinion, all the best artists are psycho a little bit, right? Caravaggio for sure, Miles Davis, you know, I mean, that guy was pretty brutal himself in real life. It just takes a certain amount of, I think, madness, I guess you could say, right? To like kind of break down reality and recreate it and present something else. Who's, I think, like Deleuze and Guattari always said that madness is a radical break from power. And I think all the best authors sort of have that like first step into the creative process.
It's funny you mentioned that dichotomy, because the other quote that I wrote down from that same first page is, I'm at odds with myself.
Right.
And that is a theme that you see Caravaggio working throughout the novel. And that idea of almost like self-imposed psychosis, where you're like, I'm going to sit down at this table or wherever you are and pretend to be this other person now. Is that something that you have to cultivate, or is that just something that comes with the territory and you're just damned with it?
I think it's something that appealed. There's so many things about Caravaggio that appealed to me in making him the subject of this book. One of the things was like, as I was reading and researching, I've been reading about him since I was an undergraduate. I'm 51 years old, probably since I was 21. But one of the things that appealed to me was just how conflicted he was and just how many different personalities and selves he had to have had coming from where he came from, a very working class family who was then sort of adopted, foster cared by, you know, the rich baroness of the town Caravaggio, because he lost every single male family. Every male family member over the course of like a week from the plague. His mom then sort of moved them into the estate of the character in the book, Costanza Collana. So he grew up, yeah, kind of poor, kind of working class, but then all of a sudden found himself living in the, you know, on the estates of this, you know, this baroness, where he became very educated, maybe received an education he wouldn't have received had he not been, you know, kind of under her foster care. Then from there, even becoming patronized by aristocrats, by cardinals, living in their palaces. He was obviously hanging out with, again, the aristocrats. He was hanging out with Galileo, probably. He was hanging out with Giordano Bruno, probably. Philosophers, artists, scientists, and all coming from this person who probably shouldn't have been there in the first place, but somehow, you know, backdoored his way in. I got a good buddy of mine, one of my best friends, is a working class Boston kid, went to a pretty, you know, great, you know, law school, but not one of the top, you would say, top Harvard Law, wherever. But he's into this, you know, was working with this huge law firm, and everyone kind of gave him that, like, how'd you get in here? What are you doing here? You know? And it's like, yeah, I'm fucking scrappy, and that's how I got in here. You know, I'm smart, I'm fucking scrappy. Right, yeah, and I feel like that's what Caravaggio, like, I'm smarter than you, I'm fucking scrappier than you, and I had a backdoor this fucking thing somehow. So I think that's, like, that Caravaggio had to have had that. And for me, like I said, too, coming from a really working class where college wasn't just, it wasn't not just talked about. It was sort of like, oh, what do you think? You can think you're going to college? Like, you're not, we don't have that kind of money. You know, we don't really, you don't have the brains. In my parents' defense, I was a horrible student. So I wasn't really supposed to be that person. I'm a college instructor now full time. And like, this was just wasn't kind of supposed to be my life. I probably was genetically designed to lay bricks, carry bricks. I'm short, powerful, carry blocks upside, you know, hillsides in Italy somewhere, probably what I should be doing. But instead I became a writer. And there is that like weird confliction with oneself, and you find yourself maybe overeducated, I'd say maybe, or just in a place you're not supposed to be. It's always a certain amount of guilt. And then I see where it, you know, sort of become sort of aware of all the different selves, and all the different selves, right, have different needs, and need to perform. It's performativity, right? All the different selves we have, it does become performative. And the first thing with performance is usually language. I think it's the first thing we change about ourselves when we're in a new environment, right? And it's the last things we change about ourselves when we leave that environment. So for me, that was like not just the history of Caravaggio and myself, sort of working class Italians, I guess. But also, as I found that really interesting from a narrative perspective, whereas where I wanted to portray him as this like Galileo, Columbus of human consciousness, and what better, this discovery he made is the first thing, if you're looking at human consciousness through a telescope like Galileo looking at Jupiter, the first thing you're going to probably see is like, oh no, there's more than what we first originally thought we saw there. There's moons around Jupiter. There's more, right? So when we're looking at the self, I think with Caravaggio was the first person to really look deep inside. I mean, he was decades before Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, 300 years before Freud. This guy was super psychological. And I think probably one of the first things you discover when you looked in, people discover when they look inward, was that like, there's more than just one person in there. There's lots of different selves. Even at a time in, you know, early modern Europe, when people were just like, you're a cobbler, or you're a carpenter, or you're a peasant, there's still, right? No one's ever just one thing, even in those days when your trade was pretty much defined you and named you even, that there's a lot of cells inside there.
I love that statement. No one's ever just one thing. That's a statement I try to live by myself, and try to give people the space to represent themselves as multiple mm-hmm. things. Man, you said a lot of stuff there that I want to cover. So how did it even happen for you, writing? Not born into a family where maybe that was on the table or a thing that you were going to be gravitating towards. So what happened?
Yeah, I don't know. I think just being a storyteller naturally. Everyone in my family is an amazing storyteller. Everyone in my family is hilarious. And growing up, again, in a very working class family, which is funny. My father was a working class guy, bricklayer, laborer. But he had great books on the bookshelf. We had Faulkner, we had Hemingway, Robert Frost, kind of all like the big hits of, you know, the baby boomer generation. So it wasn't like reading was definitely like encouraged, but not as like a pursuit academically or professionally or anything like that. What I loved as a kid, I always tell this to my son now, because he's like, you're a goofball in school. You're such a bad student. Like, what did you want to be? What were your plan? I was like, I wanted to be a comedian. I loved, you know, sort of, Rodney Dangerfield, young comedian specials would come out. I'd memorize every single line. Family members come over, I'd recite them word for word. I was always just a goofball. I think that's why I was saying, like, I don't, you know, but my last interview, my father was like, hey, you know, you said I didn't really send you to college. You know, you really weren't a good student just to make them, you know, clear the record. So.
This is not a safe
bet. So Dad, if you're listening to this podcast this time, yeah, I agree. I was a shitty student. I was not showing college material, but I did love, you know, stand-up comedy, just, again, storytelling. My mother was a great storyteller. My uncles are great storytellers. My cousin Cliff, actually, I think it was his birthday today.
Hey, it's my brother's birthday today.
Yeah. Oh, man, there you go. Cousin Cliff, he passed away a few years ago, unfortunately, but fucking great storyteller. So, is you know, in my family, if you wanted to, you know, be kind of like one of the alpha males of the family, you either had to be like beat somebody up and be really tough, because my family was pretty tough, or you had to be hilarious, or both. It always worked out, you know, which I think humor and violence kind of go hand in hand. That's something I try to pull off in this book too. But that's the storytelling started that way. When I was in, like, I didn't go to college. I had my first wife, my fiance at the time, said she was going to break up with me if I didn't go to college. My two best friends, one of them is the artist, Thomas Steininger. He was just like, yeah, you jackass. Like, why don't you go to college? Like, you're just like really intelligent, you know, smarter than me, you know, you should definitely get your ass and call another buddy of mine, Ned. They were like, they just shamed me into not going to college when I was like 21. So from there, my writing to Austin was horrible. I couldn't even write a complete sentence when I entered college. I was in one of those, like, you take a test, they place you. I mean, it was like broken sentences. I couldn't, you know, just a horrible writer in that sense. But I think I had a voice. And I went to a community college, Cape Cod Community College. That's where I started this whole thing. And I had a professor named Louise Deutsch. And there was like a homework assignment or memoir assignment, a two-page story or something. I wrote something and she was the one, like, you're a writer, you should really do more of this and write. And from there, I just sort of started and gradually. I was a philosophy major originally in undergrad, but.
Well, that's such an interesting journey to hear, because I, Caravaggio, is your first published novel, correct?
It is, yep.
But not the first one you've written. And you said you were 51, right?
I'm 51, yeah.
51?
Can't tell. Look at that.
No, you look good. 10 years younger than that.
Joking.
But that's a thing I want, you know, some of my listeners to hear, that you didn't necessarily start out going to college where you're like, okay, yeah, I went to Columbia or wherever to get my fiction degree or whatever, right. That the journeys are never as straight or as kind of planned out as people think they are. And like, right. Here you are, your book's coming out through Clash, which is an awesome publisher. Do you think in your mind through all of those things, were you like, I am going to write a novel, or was that even not on your mind at all?
No, once I started writing in the, my I think I was 30 when I started writing fiction. I was kind of I wanted to be an academic. I was taking some graduate courses at University of Rhode Island. I wanted to be a study of modernism, Pound, Eliot, George Oppen. Those kind of like my favorite poets. And I was writing some poetry, probably some really bad, I know, really bad poetry, overly academic, overly like critical, based in critical theory. It was, and there's some of them were okay. But again, my buddy, the artist there, Thomas Steininger, again, was like, hey, jackass, why don't you write some stories? Like, your poetry's okay. So I wrote a short story and I sent it into, I don't know if there's an online journal. I don't know if it's still up around. This guy, I always heard him on NPR, Andre Cotarescu. He was the editor for Exquisite Corpse. And I sent the story into them and he wrote back and they published it. It was amazing. I was like, well, after years of getting poetry rejected, the first story gets published and then the second story. And then I dropped out of URI and I started signed up. There was another, to the first MFA program I saw, there's a woman, Elizabeth Searle, whose novel I really liked, Four-Sided Bed. And I saw she taught at this, you know, new low residency program in University of Southern Maine, and I signed up for that, and they accepted. So then I switched over there and got my MFA. But once I was there, which was probably my early 30s, I knew I wanted to be write a novel and be a short story author.
Yeah. So with I, Caravaggio, you very obviously studied Caravaggio. Did your research for anyone? I mean, if you haven't read I, Caravaggio yet, it doesn't read like a straightforward, like, historical bio of Caravaggio. He's talking about his love handles. He's talking about selfies. How did you arrive at that voice for Caravaggio instead of just taking the knowledge that you very clearly have of Caravaggio and giving somebody a sort of straightforward, maybe this is sort of a crass comparison, but it kind of reminded me of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet, but where you have the equation switched, where they're not speaking in that dialect that you would have expected them to, but they're talking about, like I said, selfies and shit.
And
how'd you arrive there?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Austin. I don't know if you read, I wrote a little blog article on my blog just about that. That when I was in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when I started going, when I was just going to undergraduate, I transferred from that community college over to University of Massachusetts. And two of my favorite films when I was in my early 20s was Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet. And yeah,
I promise I didn't see the blog. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, maybe you remember there was another one right around that same time by, I'm not good with names. I think it's Richard Longcrane. Is like a British director. He did a Richard III that was same thing. And it was shot almost like in a modernist World War II Nazi Germany context with sort of this like 1930s modernist aesthetics of fascism, hairdos and mustaches of despots and vintage cars and biplanes and DC-3 airliners and all that kind of stuff, you know? So both of it, obviously, the Baz Luhrmann, Romeo plus Juliet. I mean, I love that. Being a young Gen Xer, that movie was, you got Romeo and Juliet on ecstasy.
Great soundtrack.
Yeah. I'm fucking Butthole Surfers. Fucking awesome. So when I planned to write my Caravaggio. Originally, I wanted to write this like social realist, maybe James Salter-esque, just third person. But then being me, and I always fucking make things difficult for myself, I'm like had a better idea. Like, how about three selves? And just gotta like explore this like sort of narrative idea I had. But also just my voice, I think. Like, I don't know how good of a writer I am or whatnot. But I know I have a really strong voice. That's what people always say. And I'm like, I gotta, and I related to Caravaggio again on so many different levels that I was like, now I got to make this my voice, put this in my voice. But that said, the Velvet Underground are one of my favorite bands of all time. Stones probably, then Velvet Underground, maybe like Modest Mouse. I don't know. But I, in my head, I had, so when I was thinking of the Baz Luhrmann and I was thinking of Richard III, I said, you know what? This novel needs to be written like sort of, almost like, and as I was listening to so much Velvet Underground at the time, like write this like it's like the 1970s, like dudes with big hair dressed in velvet with like switchblades and knifing each other in the dark, like shadows of Central Park, like that's sort of New York. That 1970, the more I read about early modern Rome, I was like, oh, this is just like 1970s, early 80s New York, like the punk scene.
It's filthy.
Yeah, so that's being, going way back to those. I think I had a flashback to the Baz Luhrmann film, and this is what I want my Caravaggio to be like.
Well, I think it was a good choice. It's really strong, and that part of it, I think, really, really punches into your brain. And I talked to another guy, another writer on this show called Tim, named Tim Wagner, and he has a couple books about writing. And one of the things that he talks about is what you're talking about that you did, which is you have the idea, but then you just keep pushing. Like, instead of just writing that like third person, super researched, James Salter like Caravaggio, you wrote a novel where Caravaggio's on the cover wearing aviators. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I mean, I don't know. I was going to say, I feel like that has much more of a, not interesting, but just a curve to it that people are going to take note, but I don't really know. Shit, maybe you wrote the third person Caravaggio and you're not talking to me, you're talking to NPR or somebody else.
That's just not the novel I think I was, I maybe could write a novel like that, but it's not the novel I was interested in writing. I didn't want to write this, not, no offense to Irving Stone, but like Agony and the Ecstasy, Irving Stone bullshit. Like, this is Caravaggio. Like, he needed, I think, to really get into like who he was as a person, who was as a, his personality, his aesthetic, his psychology. It needed to be like, I don't even consider this a historical novel at all. Honestly, I feel like it's just a contemporary novel set in the early 1600s. That's the way I kind of tell people when they ask me, is it a historical novel? I'm like, yeah, maybe just as a label to maybe, sell, but no, I don't consider it a historical novel at all.
Even they certainly speak in, contemporary language and the things they're referencing and those kinds of things, but they are walking around with like swords and daggers and riding horses and stuff. Exactly. But yeah, I don't know that I would consider it a historical novel just because it feels very timely. Like it feels now, and not just because of the things that they reference. I think probably that's part of because of how you wrote it and your voice. But I think Caravaggio is kind of relevant because of the things that you present him doing and worrying about.
Right. No, I think he was sort of the first, I mean, I've said this before in other interviews, he was the first of so many things. I said before, he was proto-Freudian, right? He discovered human consciousness. He was proto-Hollywood. And these pictures of him, and that's what I read a biography by, called M, The Man Who Became Caravaggio, by Peter Robb. And he does a great job of sort of like relabeling a lot of Caravaggio's paintings to almost like movie titles to come across like these were like the original blockbusters, right? These were proto-Hollywood in the sense he like with chiaroscuro and maybe the camera obscura techniques, he kind of really came up with a very like cinematic way of painting. But also culturally, I mean, these things were, people were lined up around the blocks, the piazzas of Italy, to see these things because the Catholic Church was in a culture war with the Protestants and the Reformation. They needed to get asses in pews. And Caravaggio's paintings did that. He was like the equivalent of like a Hollywood movie director, of Martin Scorsese, and I think he is, I mean, he's probably every, your favorite director, you know, your favorite Hollywood director's favorite artist is Caravaggio, 100%. I mean, people just ripping off his techniques still to this day. But I think that was important, why he also needed to have this contemporary tone, because he was like proto-Freudian, proto-Hollywood. He was proto-Marxist in a lot of ways. I mean, these are democratic spaces, I like to call them, that he was painting, places where peasants and prostitutes and laborers were being idolized as saints, right? He wasn't just like picking, using aristocrats off the street, you know, aristocrats to paint or famous people. He was just, he would say like, I just need to go to the street to find my subjects and I'll paint real life, you know, like their dirty fingernails, their crooked teeth, their bruises, their sunburned necks from working out in in the sun of the Mezzogiorno, whatever. But very like, I mean, again, proto, I think Marxist in that sense too, empowering, liberating, right?
Is that what led you to, or I mean, does that have any connection at all for you having them have the conversations that they have? I think at one point someone bends down and sniffs his crotch and is like, it smells like roses. Is it because you humanity is never as clean as maybe a painting would, you know, prior to Caravaggio's time, present us, you know, very, you know, staid and right, silent and still. There's a lot more going on. Is that, were you like, okay, let's dive in.
That's for Caravaggio. His rivals at the time were the Mannerist painters who did the opposite of what he did. They glorified everything. And for lack of a better term, they airbrushed their paintings, right? The saints they painted, Caracci, their necks were elongated. Everyone's features were sort of like, you know, improved upon and looked angelic, and everything was, all the annunciations, all the martyrdoms, everything was all blissful. Caravaggio is just like, no, you're going to get what Peter really probably looked like upside down on a cross, right? In this moment, during his worst moment. Like George Saunders once in an interview, I heard him say something like he liked to write his short stories about people experiencing their worst days. And a lot of his characters are these sort of, I think he's a kind of a Catholic dude himself. A lot of his characters do have these like saint-like qualities about them, like flawed people who have this sort of epiphany and either, you know, like maybe there's some minor, I don't know, like blissful, epiphany that occurs throughout it. But with Caravaggio, he literally was painting these people again on their worst days, right? Like while they were but for a saint, your worst day is kind of your best day, right? Your worst day is the moment in which you become like forever and eternalized.
Redefine your life.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, Caravaggio, and it was, he wanted to, I think, pay honor to the reality, I think, was one of the first people like, let's stop Photoshopping these moments and let's start like giving you like what they probably really look like. Like what, they didn't look all beatific and everything else while they were being killed, you know, St. Matthew. There was probably agony and horror and pain, right? And that's why, I mean, what he was doing too is incredibly against the law, against, you know, it was
oh, sure.
painting prostitutes as the virgin, but even just, again, painting them in pain, painting them not glorifying it, right? But like showing the real violence of it.
Well, you said one word in there has me curious, and you know, feel free to tell me, let's move on. Catholic was the one word that I heard. Is that a part of your life that helped you define what you're going to write about, or no?
Yeah, 100%. I think I just identified with it growing up in an Italian family, Catholic, the guilt, you know, the neuroses.
Those were the two things, the guilt and the neuroses that I was curious about, because being a writer who's not Catholic, I have plenty of those things. Mm-hmm. How did that define your early writing life, even up to now?
Yeah, man, it's funny, I'm having such a weird religious moment in the last like probably year since I finished the novel. I grew up incredibly Catholic. I mean, there was a time when I was young, I think I thought I would maybe, I was like, maybe I'm the next Jesus. You know, I was like so Catholic that, you know, like I was, my mom definitely.
That is Catholic.
Yeah, my mom talked me up like I was, you know, when she wasn't. My mom did this beautiful thing of like talking me up like I was the next Jesus, but she'd also like backhand me if I was being an asshole too. But she, I was extremely religious, extremely Catholic up until probably high school, maybe when my parents divorced and, you know, my mom started, sort of went down a pretty rocky road after the divorce of just like substance abuse and things like that. And I think I just sort of maybe had my apostasy. It was kind of before that probably, but was completely, I understood that psyche, you know, I understood that that's the Catholic psyche for sure. And then going into writing this novel, again, like understanding it, I was still pretty atheistic, I would say, like a complete, like, you know, Catholic, you know, not even a recovering Catholic, just a straight atheist. But since finishing the novel and spending time in churches, looking at paintings and things, and it's, I think that's what the Catholics do. It's got me feeling pretty Catholic again. I got to admit, I've been having these like Catholic cravings, and I don't know what to do with them, to be honest with you, Austin.
Well, hey, I mean, when you're the one who's in control of it, I think it maybe is a little different. I kind of grew up without religion. And from my perspective, you know, my mom, I think, has several times said, of course we're Christians. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I've never felt like that. My writing has always been separate from those feelings or thoughts. Maybe to my detriment, I don't really know. But you did also, like, this kind of connects with a thing you said earlier, where you said, I don't know how good of a writer I am, which is a thing I always wonder about for myself too. Is that, like, what do you think, if there is any connection, maybe there's no connection, of Catholicism saying like, you need to prove that you're worth enough for this. You need to overcome this guilt of like original sin. And is there, do you think if there's any kind of connection between self-doubt?
Yeah.
Self-doubt.
That's interesting.
I guess self-perception. Caravaggio, being the subject of your book, who was very obviously interested in examining himself. I talk about doubt and stuff a lot on the show because I'm very interested in how it affects my own writing. How has it played a part in your life?
Yeah, no, I am like so good at self-doubt and self-loathing and self-sabotage.
Yeah.
I think I'm like always been my harshest critic. I think goes back to maybe my trying to outdo my dad. My dad is a super loving, supportive dude in a lot of ways, but he was also pretty critical in terms of like, just, yeah, like, again, I wasn't, not in an academic way, but like sports especially, you know.
Yeah.
I was really good at like martial arts, boxing when I was a kid, full contact. I was like competed pretty competitively and all that. And I remember like, you know, I was probably 15, 16. They wouldn't even let me like spar any kids my own age anymore. I was like sparring like grown men, adults, when I was like 15, 16. And I'd like do pretty well, like knock some dude down, win a match, you know. On the way home, my dad would always be like, yeah, you got lucky there. You know, you dropped your right hand once. Your lucky Wayne didn't come over the top and tag you on that. I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? I'm 15. I just fucking knocked out a grown man, you know, like, come on. Yeah, I think that was part of my dad's thing. My mom was like, you're Jesus. And my dad's like, no, you're, you know, like, it was, his job was to like come bring me down a little bit. But yeah, I'm just really good at just, I'm like definitely my own, you know, my largest critic. And I think always, yeah, writing this novel in particular, like I had really high hopes for it. It had that big vision, that sort of like platonic ideal in my head that I wanted this, you know, it all to like wrap up this perfect way. And, you know, I think I kind of came close to that, and I'm pretty happy with the novel. But I think in general, I just say things like, I don't know how good of a writer I am, thinking, I don't know, because I feel like that's, I have to have a little bit of self-doubt and a little bit of self-criticism just to, I don't know, I'm not doing a podcast. That just seems even too self-important for me right now. Like, really? Like, this guy really wants to talk about my book right now? Like who cares, you know? Like,
I know what you mean. I definitely know what you mean.
But I feel bad for you right now that you have to even, you know, like, sit here.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to a friend, maybe it was like 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago at this point. I was talking about writing and, you know, publishing something. And I said something about my stuff not being good or something along those same lines. And I think I've told the story on the show before. He was like, but you don't really think that.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you submit it. Like, you don't really think that. And I was like, shit.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I think you're right. I think when I said, I don't know how good of a writer I am, because I was going to actually pump my own tires about how strong my voice is on the page. And I think I felt obligated to say, like, yeah, I don't know if I'm a good writer or not, but I have this fucking amazing narrative voice. And I do know I have an amazing narrative voice. Like, I will go toe to toe with that over Andy. Like, I'll, you know, give me an author and I'll go in the ring with them about over the, you know, over that. That's something other writers, you know, teachers over the years. I'm like, yeah, your voice is crazy. So I do know I have a great writing voice. But I didn't want to, like, you know.
Well, big. Yeah, no, it is a weird balance. Like, there's this Bruce Springsteen quote I love where he talks about having to know that you are the best, mm-hmm. and knowing that you suck.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to hold these things in mind at the same time. And it's kind of impossible, but it's like this big fight.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're gonna flex, which I don't mind. I mean, I'm Italian. Like, we love flexing. We love showing off, like, how awesome we are at everything. I mean, where would the world be if it wasn't for Italians? But for me though, that's where I grew up in a Boston Irish neighborhood where it was like, oh, you fucking think you're better than me, you know? Everyone is on the same page. You can't. So if you're gonna flex, you gotta, like, self-deprecate first. That yep. makes it okay. You know, that's like the Irish American ethos, like the self-deprecation, which is the community I mostly grew up in.
Well, I have a couple more questions about the historical nature of the novel. One of them, maybe kind of weird. What's the deal with civets?
I know, right? That was one of those research things. Like, wait, like, cologne came from a rat's asshole? Like, you know, like, sort of civet anus? Like, you know, so... I just like the word civet, and I love words. I could, like, spend all day just looking at a sentence. I love civet anus. Just had, like, a great ring to it. I just
it very obviously stuck out to me because I was like, wait, didn't I just read about that? And it stuck out, but I think that kind of context and that kind of, like, color, so to speak, right. is good and another thing that makes the voice as strong as it is.
Yeah, because sometimes in writing, you got to find a clever way to make it contemporary. Like, you can't just say, like, I don't give a rat's ass. Like, you don't want it to be too contemporary. So you got to find ways, like, all right, if they use civets, then maybe they would say, like, civet anus. Or I don't know. Like, so it sounded slangy enough, but also Latinate. And that's why I liked it.
Yeah. No, it's good.
It's like a French origin meets Latinate. I don't know. I just like the way that it's strung together.
It works. How did you write this? Did you write longhand? You write on a computer? How'd you do it?
I wrote some of it on my notepad, on my phone at night. Son was pretty young then. He's 9 now. He's probably 3, 4, 5 when I was writing it, and just, you know, juggling the responsibilities of, like, parenthood and work. I wrote a lot of it, you know, between 2 and 5 o'clock in the morning, laying down the living room floor, you know, on my stomach, you know, horrible back pocket. Doing that. Yeah, just mostly on a laptop. Notes on my phone when I had a moment, like, something would come to me. I keep it next to my bed, airplane mode, as I'm freaking out about, like, I don't want to get, like, a brain tumor or anything like that. But I roll over. I always, like, you know, take notes. We live in a small house, and we live in LA. We got, like, maybe 1,000-square-foot house. So it's pretty, you got to be pretty careful at night, not waking anyone up or putting too many lights on. So, yeah, I kind of creep out in the living room and we just have a laptop, phone notes, and some longhand notes for sure. Sometimes I'm all over the place. I think a little bit of, depending on, sometimes I feel like maybe I'm in a longhand. Some ideas are better jotted down, different. The medium is the message kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask, how does it feel writing longhand? Do you feel like you use more from one place
than
the other?
Conceptually, I think phones are fine for me because I'm just, like, getting the idea now, and I'm just sort of maybe drafting something, an idea. Usually it's a conceptual thing. But then on the page, And same thing with longhand. But on the page, I feel like I write fairly fast, but I go over, like, I don't move on to a paragraph until, like, the paragraph is, like, perfect for me. And then I go to the next paragraph. And then that takes me a lot of, like, cutting and pasting sentences and rearranging them and apparent, you know, sort of these sort of...
Do you do that no matter how you're writing? If it's longhand or computer, you don't move past
it? No, just on the computer. Just the computer. I'm actually, like, taking the ideas I've sort of compiled and putting it on the laptop. Then I kind of go with, like, a cut and paste, rearranging the paragraph until it's like the shape and sound that I like.
How many drafts do you think you did of I Caravaggio?
Probably three.
Yeah.
I think three. Yeah. Three. Not including that first, like, 20 pages of that, like, Psalter-esque, like, I think I got about 20 pages into that. I was like, no, this isn't
not working.
Not this one. But that was, yeah, there was some good stuff maybe there, but I was like, no, this isn't what I want to write. This isn't the Caravaggio I want to do.
Yeah. So. Did you edit it yourself? Did you get an outside editor to submit to Clash? What was the sort of...
I did, yeah. I edited it myself. I had my two readers edit it, a fellow friend, really good friends of mine, authors, David Schumann and Colette Sartor. They kind of edited it for me. And then I hired, like, an outside editor to do it. And she was just, by the end... I think because I'm such a meticulous reviser and editor, because I don't paragraph to paragraph. My wife's an amazing proofreader too. I have her go over it. So yeah, it was in pretty good shape. She had a few suggestions, with the opening paragraph scene that I thought were huge. And then I sent it off to Clash.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I caught them right. I mean, I just feel like they're like the perfect poem. Perfect palazzo for my Caravaggio to dwell in, for sure.
Yeah. Kind of the last thing I want to talk about is how you think you work at Loyola Marymount University as a professor of rhetoric, which I was super interested in as far as how that connects to fiction or storytelling in general. The role that rhetoric maybe plays in telling stories and how you do what you do with I Caravaggio and other stuff that you're writing.
Yeah, that's funny. I was teaching creative writing mostly at a university in Rhode Island, a small college in Rhode Island, before I moved to LA, met my wife, fell in love, dropped everything, rushed, like, within, like, months, just rushed out here. No job, nothing, no prospects. Just literally dropped everything within months and came out here. And then I just sent some CVs out. And Loyola Marymount got back to me and said, hey, we have these courses called rhetorical. Well, one of the courses they had available was called Rhetorical Arts. And it was, like, writing and speaking for social justice. And it's part of this, like, pedagogical, Jesuit pedagogy and things. And I was like, wow, that sounds... I've always been very kind of politically minded as well. That sounds kind of right up my alley. So not being a rhetorician, you know, by training, but being a writer for sure. And quickly, realizing that, although I don't consider writing creatively rhetorical at all, because I think to be rhetorical is like the study of persuasion. And there's, for me, writing this novel, I mean, there's no persuasion.
Yeah.
I mean, I had like two people in mind when I was writing this. I was, sort of good online friends with Giancarlo Di Trapano. And I sent him a draft or two of this, and we went back and forth about it. And I was like, I was maybe just hoping he would publish it. But otherwise, like, I had no audience for this. In the study of rhetoric, like, your audience is just as important as, the pathos, just as important as you, the ethos, the author, the speaker. So for me, the rhetorical, the purpose of writing is different, but the strategies are all there and the same. This in my courses, and we talk about language strategies, study language strategies, parallelism, metonyms, metaphors, everything, right? So that part of it 100% translates over to creative writing. And I feel like it has... I've been teaching this course now for 10 years. It's definitely improved my writing. And there is, when we talk about ethos in the course too, and this, like, reflection of values and the qualities of the speaker and narrative voice and things like that, it 100% translates. And I've been interested in maybe, right, I haven't written an academic piece since graduate school, but I've been really interested in get some ideas for just, writing this an academic critical essay about voice and crossover from rhetoric into creative writing. But
so when you're going to write either I Caravaggio or another novel or even a short story, you mentioned knowing your audience or having an audience. When do you think about that when you're writing a story?
I just, yeah, for a while, I think when I was writing short stories, I've been publishing like short stories in literary journals online and print for decades now. I feel like I've sort of always been around the scene, low key, kind of here and there, some good publications, you know, like, and earlier when I was writing stories and publishing a lot of stories, my audience in some ways was maybe like my family members, like my mom, my dad, in ways of like how not to hurt them. And, you know, in terms of like what I was writing about, not, there's so much good fucking rich information. And I just wanted to make it entertaining. I wasn't trying to like out them or make them look sure. a certain way or make like bad people. But I mean, both my parents have been in prison. Both my parents, they're just, you can't have parents like this and not make them into characters. So
right.
I do think sometimes it was like my parents, like how can I aestheticize them, you know, without, you know, totally hurting their feelings. But otherwise I never really thought of that. You know, honestly, I'm one of those, I hate to sound cliche like that, but like, I don't have an audience. I write for myself, but, and maybe I should write more about that. Maybe why I'm 51 years old, just having my first novel out. But
well, that's part of why I asked, because some people say it's death to be like, yeah. Who's this for? And some right. people be like, if you're going to sell it, you have to know who it's for. Right. But there's, I think you can find a justification for kind of every single concept of, as far as like, I don't think about the audience. I have a story and I want to tell it. If there's an audience, cool. If there's not, then I'll write another thing. And if that's how you do it, like I have gotten to the point, and maybe this is how you work as well, where it's just like, I just want to tell this story. And if it means it's going to get published, cool. Of course that would be neat, but if not, yeah, move on to the next thing.
For this novel, especially, Austin, I agree. I just kind of got to the point where I didn't care if anyone liked it, if anyone published it. I was sort of beyond, like, I kind of was already resigned to the fact that I was never going to publish a novel after writing my first novel, which I thought was, you know, fucking fantastic. Some other people thought it was fantastic, kind of made some rounds, and just, you know, for whatever reasons, didn't find a home or even find, you know, but with this one, I was resigned. I'm like, hey, whatever. It might never happen. I don't care. I'm just going to write the novel I want to write. I was even afraid of that. Like, who's going to like this novel? Like, I felt like some literary types might not know what to make of it, right? Because everyone always says, like, I want something original. But then you give them something original and they're afraid of it. They want to be the first person to say, this is incredible or this is really unique. And then someone might shit on their, you know, on that opinion. So, like, no one has the balls to really actually, like, promote something truly unique, I think. So I was sort of over it. I'm just like, I don't care. You know, I really don't care. In some ways, I want to just even entertain, like, not non-literary readers, you know? Like, I don't know if there's the very few of them that are out there, but people who, you know, read semi-literary work, you know, but without, who aren't writers, right? And from those, among those people, I feel like I've had, like, the best responses to the book. There's a couple of guys, one of my readings came up to me, he's like a screenwriter for years, and he was just like, man, this book is like nothing I've ever read, and this is incredible to me, like, I'm so into it. Like, he's just, because I think he was just enjoying the experience of reading it, of reading, you know, Sivananis, and not being like, oh, can you say that, or is like, can you, you know, like, what's he doing here? Like, I haven't read this in any of my fucking MFA program classes. Like, what's he doing? Is this so acceptable? It's like, yeah, it's fucking acceptable and it's amazing. So I can drink it down. Right? fucking, I were thinking it. So just, you know, let it fuck you up a little bit.
No, I think that's a good way to look at it, especially yeah. with independent publishers, places like Clash that aren't doing the same things as far as like, they're not worried about the book being the thing that like
right.
A book club on ABC is going to talk about or mm-hmm. of course those things are cool because your book obviously sells more because of it, but telling interesting stories and unique stories, I think, which isn't to say that those other stories are less valuable or no. like having fun with a book and telling Caravaggio's story the way that you did doesn't have to mean that mm-hmm. it's low art.
No, 100%. And I think there's some pretty high art, like inventive narrative structure stuff going in the book as well. That if you want to geek out on, you know, craft, there's that for you there too, right? I just, maybe some people can't get over the four letter words and the content a little bit to see that. I stand by it that like aesthetically as well, in terms of like, you know, yeah, it's structured and everything else, that it's just, there's some pretty cool stuff going on there too for people to check out.
I think so too. I think it works. And I think everybody should go check it out. I Caravaggio from Clash Books. Hey, thank you so much for coming on, Eugenio. I appreciate this so much, man.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate taking the time to going over. Yeah, like I said, feel bad for anyone who's gonna, like, you know, and I'm honored that anybody would want to, like, sit down and talk about the book.
Thank you so much to Eugenio for stopping by, chatting about I Caravaggio, his process, civets, all that stuff. You can buy I Caravaggio right now from Clash Books. So go to either clashbooks.com and find it wherever books are sold, or go to eugeniovolpe.com. Check it out there. I appreciate you listening, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you.